Blog Talk Radio. Firefly Willows LIDE presents Revolution, featuring your host, Heisi Lutmers.
Weekly round table. I'm here in Studio C, live from Los Altos, joined by Mildred Lynn McDonald.
Hello.
John Caracella.
Hello.
And Deb Caracella.
Good morning.
And our topic today is hopefully something that will, if nothing else, bring a smile to our face. We're going to talk about joy. What is it? What can we do to cultivate it? How is it that we can express joy in our lives, and how do we know when we're in joy? And also, sometimes, what are the things that we do that may cause our own joy to be overshadowed? Or what gets in the way of us being able to fully experience and live in joy? For me, one of the things I think of course, because I work with the Tarot, is joy is the Sun card. And the Sun card is just about letting whatever is within us shine forth out into the world fully and completely without any barrier, any judgment, any limitation to its expression. So who we are is what the world sees. It's like being naked in front of the world. And who likes us, who loves us for that, we're extremely appreciative and grateful for. And who doesn't, we don't worry about. That's not what our joy is dependent on, the validation and acceptance of others. So I'm curious what you might think of when you think of the word joy, when you think of what it means to feel or express joy, and how we can best live our lives in a state of joy.
What you said in your introductory comment about the Sun card and in a sense being naked in the world, it reminds me of the ecstatic Persian poets, Hafez, Rumi, and I think there was also a woman poet who wrote about this very thing of you know you are one with God when you are willing to run into the middle of the town and stand in the street naked. Imagine being that willing to be wholly visible and completely yourself, that you would actually do that in downtown Los Altos, perhaps, right? You're so ecstatic with confidence that you and your creator are together. You're so confident that the creator loves you that you're willing to be completely exposed.
And a nice policeman down the corner loves you too.
Well, but I think that it speaks to a word that is defined in different ways, which is freedom. Because it's feeling the freedom to do that, to run into the middle of town, to expose yourself in that way. Then there are man-made freedoms, which are very different than true freedom. And I think joy is a reflection of internal freedom, where we have freed ourselves to be ourselves in the world, rather than basing who we are and what we do on what other people say, think, how they do or don't validate or accept us. And from that, I'm wondering what you might also think of would be the difference, if you think there is one, between happiness and joy.
Well, I think about happiness as being an aspect of joy. Somehow joy is a deeper place, a deeper expression of happiness, a deeper expression of that ecstatic feeling of things are good, things are right for me, things are right with the world and between me and the world. I think happiness is a little less transcendent and a little more situational. You know, there are moments when I experience happiness. Another way to say this maybe is that one can find joy even in circumstances of tragedy. Whereas I don't necessarily think one would say that you would find happiness in circumstances of tragedy.
I know when I first started to do energy work, I explored the concept of joy a little bit. And when I go inside and meditate or do a visualization, the question came up a lot, why am I here? What is my purpose? And I'm sure many, many people ask the same thing. I'm not unusual in that aspect. And time after time, what would come up for me is, you're here to experience the joy of being alive. And every way I asked that question about other people or myself, and I tried many different angles, it always came out to the same thing. You're here to experience the joy of being alive. So that left me with a wide open canvas to start exploring, you know, what joy meant to me or means to me, and where joy lived in my body and how I expressed joy and all those things. It was a cornucopia of endless hours of reflection that I'll not bore everybody with right now. But it seems to be something very fundamental to the human condition.
For me, personally, happiness, I find, as John mentioned earlier, is something a little bit more fleeting. It's something that's a little bit more dependent upon outside circumstances or events. Joy, I find for myself to be very simple and very serene, that it doesn't require a lot of bells and whistles for me to find joy. Joy is usually quiet and not without intensity, but it is something that is very internal, and it's a response, it's a deep response to something as simple as the way the light plays across the clouds, or seeing a kid throwing a ball and his dog running across the field, ears flapping in the wind. That's joyful to me. And it not only does it bring a sense of joy and connectedness within me, just seeing the purity of the joy of the interaction between the child and their dog is very simple and very complete, very fulfilling.
Do you think we're hardwired in some ways as a collective to experience joy?
I think that, yes, we are. I don't think that we all always allow ourselves to. I think we create many, many reasons and scenarios not to experience joy. There has to be a formula, or we have to have to meet certain goals, or we have to have certain things in order to be joyful. You know, if you don't have this, and this, well, how can you be joyful? They're not necessary. Being aware of who you are, being comfortable with who you are, experiencing the serenity of just being, and allowing the goodness of just being and the others and the other beings around you can be very, very joyful and fills you with joy. So for me, joy is quiet, joy is simple, and it's very filling. It's a sense of fullness.
I heard a quote, I can't remember who it should be attributed to. It goes like this: joy is your soul's message to you that you're doing the right thing, or that you're in the right place in the world, or something like that.
Well, and that makes me think of a way that when I think of the word joy, I think of the letters representing just own yourself. And that means it comes from within me, my joy, and I'm not trying to own someone or something else by saying, I need you to be this way for me to be joyful. Mm-hmm. Really what we would say is, I need you to be this way for me to be happy, which again is very different than joy. And if you just own yourself, it says, I only focus on who I need to be, what I am here to do in the world, and making myself the best I can be. Because you can find joy anywhere you look for it if you make the conscious effort. And when you start looking for it, and more importantly, when you start living in joy, you'll find that your world is surrounded by things that are joyful or support joy, or that you attract joy into your life.
You know, one of the things where that's, it might be easier to find and to experience joy is out in nature. Because in nature, there isn't a lot of judgment. There isn't a lot of self-judgment. There isn't a lot of judging of others. Whereas in human culture and human society, we have so many wounds and so many structures that don't serve us well that we are constantly in this place of being irritated. But when you're out in the woods by yourself, the only set of obstacles you have to overcome are your internal ones. And to shed your judgments about yourself or your sense of need or whatever and to just be out there in nature seems to me to be a place where joy is very readily experienced for me.
Well, I'm going to challenge that in some way because, one, I'm going to say that, and it goes back to something Mildred had mentioned earlier, sometimes I think we fall into the trap of we think that in order for us to experience joy, we see how someone else is experiencing or found joy. And now if we can do that, then I will experience joy rather than finding joy in our own way. And being in nature, I would say you don't have to be anywhere to be in joy because you can be in joy anywhere you are, whether that's in the woods or whether that's in a prison cell. You can be in joy. Now, you may not be happy that you're in a prison cell, but you can still be in joy being in the prison cell rather than saying, well, I would be joyful or I would be experiencing joy if I was in the woods rather than this prison cell, because joy isn't dependent on that. Joy comes from that core of ourselves. And I think the collective part, the collective hardwiring, can be seen, and this probably sounds silly, in posts that people make to Facebook. If somebody posts a picture saying, here's a picture of the couch I just ordered for my living room, well, people can look at it and, oh, that's pretty, you know, or whatever, but it may say nothing to me. And so it's like, well, good for them for finding a couch they wanted. I'm glad they're happy with it. There's that word.
Mm-hmm.
However, if somebody is, say, out on the beach and they post a picture of a sunset at the beach that they just saw, when other people seeing that on Facebook see that same picture of the sunset, it evokes that same kind of, oh, that's so beautiful. Oh, you know, it takes me there. It's not, oh, I'm glad you got to see that sunset, but it doesn't do anything for me. Versus there seems to be a more visceral kind of response, which I think speaks to the hard wiring of the ability to experience joy as a collective versus happiness, which maybe is a more individual experience depending on individual circumstance or surrounding or something like that.
It's interesting how you hear people say, I just want to be happy, or I'll be happy when. You don't hear as much people saying, I just want to be joyful. I'll be joyful when.
True.
Yeah, because if you actually say those words, I think it triggers an understanding that you actually can be joyful anytime you want.
Yeah, joy seems to be outside of time and space.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, and if joy arises from you versus happiness being somehow dependent on something else,
mm-hmm.
then if you say, I just want to be happy, you can say, I'm not happy because of, and be able to make it an external reason, excuse, or justification that you're not happy. If you say, I want to be joyful, and you're not, you're forced to have to look at, well, then what is it about me and what I'm doing or not doing or causing myself to be that keeps me from being in joy? And people don't want to have to go to the hard work of looking in themselves and doing what they need to do, because I'd rather just be happy, which means as long as the external circumstances can meet my criteria, and then if they don't, well, then it's all their fault that I'm not happy.
Is there a capitulation in giving up the desire to will reality into a shape that makes you happy, and instead going inward and saying, I will experience joy regardless of the external circumstances? It feels like a surrender.
It feels like the words of Viktor Frankl. Well, when everything else is taken away, a man has the choice, or a woman has the choice, to determine what that means. What they choose to make something mean whatever. That's their choice. So you have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that people are always looking for happiness, but we often get stuck in, what do I need to do to be happy? And so maybe if I do this, maybe if I do this, and whether it's maybe if I buy this house or whether it's maybe if I take this workshop on, you know, soul retrieval. But it's always about, what do I need to do to be happy? And joy, I think, is the lack of doing. It's when we learn to let go of trying or needing to do versus allowing ourselves to simply be.
Mm-hmm.
And it's when we stop and simply be that we can allow for and feel joy emerging, which isn't necessarily without its challenges, because that might still bring up the things that we ourselves are doing or causing to get in the way of that joy being able to fully come through and be expressed in ourselves and in our lives. But it's when we stop doing or trying so hard to seek out or to grasp happiness or what we think will make us happy, that joy now has a place to come in and fill.
You know, this reminds me of our cherry tree in front of our home. When that cherry tree is in bloom, I feel like the cherry tree is experiencing joy. And when that cherry tree is in full fruit and those cherries are so bright red and juicy, I feel like the cherry tree is experiencing joy. Like there's joy in the cherry. So, and of course, when I hold the cherry in my hand, I experience joy because somehow I'm in communion with the joy that is the cherry, that is in the cherry and that is in the cherry tree,
the
beingness of the tree. I love it. It makes me feel, it evokes in me a transcendent feeling of joy.
And to me, I think that's the difference between happiness and joy. Happiness is a personal thing. Joy is transpersonal, and what you're experiencing is transpersonal because you're connecting and resonating with the joy that the cherry tree is expressing and experiencing, and then it's now resonating with you, and you're experiencing that joy as well. Mm. That's because I've gone beyond my personal self, which would say, well, I don't know what a cherry tree feels, so how could I possibly experience what it's feeling, which we could then extrapolate out. Well, I don't know what that person is feeling, so how can I be happy? Because I don't know what they're feeling. I can't feel that. Whereas joy we can feel because it resonates at that much deeper level. And we're connecting to that interconnectedness of all things rather than the personal expression or experience of life.
And where does joy resonate in the body?
Yeah, I feel it. I feel it in my second, third, and fourth chakras mostly. And then when it's really fully resonating, then it moves up into my throat as well.
Really?
Right? Yeah, because one of the clearest ways for me to know that I'm in joy, I know that I'm jubilant when I'm making music.
Okay.
When I'm singing or playing music, it makes me joyful.
And I think that for me, I would say third, fourth chakra as well, which is kind of solar plexus and heart, and probably the heart. Ultimately is the seat of joy if you think of the heart being the center, because I think joy resides in our core. That's why we always want to center and come back to our core self and be in stillness when we have all sorts of things going on, if we want to come back to that place of joy. And then it comes up to your throat, because once we've experienced it within ourselves, it wants to be expressed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, when the cherry tree is in joy, it wants that joy to be expressed through the cherries that it bears the fruit of.
Yeah.
And so I think that's why it ultimately would move up. I don't know that it would reside in the throat.
No, exactly.
But I think it moves
exactly
up to there, because now it wants to be expressed. But I think it resides, for me anyway, in the core, which is kind of in that center place, which I would go to, of course, the third, fourth chakra area, because that just seems to be that central place.
Mm-hmm. I find it's in my third and fourth chakra, and it also gives me a sense of taking my breath away.
Mm.
It's like, but it's ongoing. Be in a state of awe,
yeah,
right.
Joy and awe,
right? And I agree. I don't believe joy is not something you experience intellectually. Joy isn't something you experience in your head. You experience it in the center of who you are, and typically for humans, that is our core. That is the heart area, and joy rather than song, for me, would be laughter. Just the uninhibited, open-hearted laugh of just joy.
Not having to do anything.
Right. That when something catches you without, you don't expect the laughter to come bubbling out, and yet it does. And it's not laughter in the sense of, oh, someone tripped on a banana peel kind of laughter. It's the expression of complete joy, and it's just something that needs to escape the body. It wants to be shared. And song is one mechanism, but just listening to a child, listening to a baby, when you first do the peekaboo or whatever, and they just erupt into giggles. That's just pure joy with no other, you know, they don't care about how much it costs to get their little booties. They didn't care about this, that. There is nothing for them but the moment and what has they've just experienced and their response, and which is just delight.
And I think that's the difference between happiness and joy. Happiness, like Mildred was saying, is when I'm happy or I'm looking for happiness, whereas joy is something that just comes upon you.
Mm.
And it's when you've gotten out of the way so that what's in that core can just arise and emerge and then be expressed. But you suddenly just experience or feel joy. Mm. It's not something you go looking for or you necessarily expect. It just happens.
Mm.
And that's, I think, how you can differentiate for yourself sometimes. What am I experiencing? Am I experiencing just happiness or am I experiencing joy? And if it just came upon you, that's joy. Thank you, everyone, for being here and engaging in this. And may you all have a joyful week.
Thank you, I see.
And if you have any thoughts on joy and what it means to you or what the experience of joy is, feel free to continue this conversation on our Facebook page at facebook.com/fireflywillows. And it's always interesting to see where the conversation goes and what takes off beyond this particular roundtable discussion in that forum. So we encourage you to join us there and offer your thoughts and insights as well.
At Firefly Willows LIVE, we're working hard to be your trusted source for fun, enlightening, and heart-centered information and community. And we're passionate about the art of transformative media, the new leading edge of communication in our highly connected, media-rich world. If you're passionate about facilitating change and you have gifts or ideas you'd like to share, come join us, host a show, or be a guest. Or connect us to an amazing speaker or teacher whose message is too good to miss. There's always room for courageous, knowledgeable changemakers, inspired artists, and new ideas. Let us know you're interested. Send an email to info@fireflywillows.com. We're Firefly Willows, LIVE, helping you find and shine your inner light.
Hello, dear listeners, and welcome back to your astrology update with James Moran. This is part 3 of our summer focus on Jupiter. This is our astrology update for August 2013, and we began the summer in June talking about Jupiter's transit into Cancer and what that meant for everybody, according to their sun sign in the zodiac. Whatever your sun sign was, we talked about this transit of Jupiter into Cancer, which will last for the next year, what it means for you, according to what sign you were born in. And in July, we spoke about what is called the Great Water Trine of this coming year as well. Jupiter in Cancer, and Neptune in Pisces, and Saturn in Scorpio. Also, for the next year, those three planets will be there, all trining each other. That means they're all 120 degrees from each other, nice soft angles. It means that they're all in supportive, flowing alignment. The archetypes of all three are flowing together with ease, creating a supportive atmosphere for the visionary, this practical visionary is what we spoke of in the July podcast. So now we have the third part of the installment is the new alignment that Jupiter just came into as it progressed closer to mid-Cancer. It has come into what's called a T-square with Pluto and Uranus. And a T-square means that Pluto, in the middle of Capricorn, is 180 degrees in the sky from Jupiter in the middle of Cancer. So that means they're on opposite ends of the sky. They're in opposition to each other. That's a hard angle.
creating tension, creating catalyzation of the archetypes involved. And then Uranus is in mid Aries, which is right in between those, 90 degrees from both of those positions. So Uranus is also in a tense angle, a lot of tension there in a T-square to propel us into growth. So we're coming into August, the final installment of our focus on Jupiter, with the most explosive of the alignments that we spoke of. This is the fireworks show of all the alignments we spoke of because, again, of the hard angles involved. So what is the archetype of Pluto? The archetype of Pluto is the archetype of the power of nature to evolve, change, transform, bring about decay and death of the old structures and birth of new life, new forms, associated with the instinctual and biological drives to create new life, overturn the old. And it's associated with almost, it could be thought of as the will of life, the will of life to keep on living. So that's Pluto. Uranus is the archetype of liberation, rebellion. Those two have already been in tense aspect. They've been in a square aside from this Jupiter transit. Aside from Jupiter entering into the alignment, those two have been in tension since 2008. And it's they were the two that were in tension in the 1960s, which is why these recent years have felt like so much like the 60s, the protests breaking out across the world. So that is the desire for freedom getting propelled by that plutonic power. It's almost like an instinctual, suddenly when those two come in contact, it's like the instinctual just power of the human unconscious suddenly propels this desire for freedom, this desire for rebellion. So that's the alignment of Uranus and Pluto. Jupiter is that which grants expansion and the higher heights, the larger abundance, the larger whole, expands. It's the largest planet. So with all those three in hard aspect, what do we get? Well, we have a very exciting mixture which looks very much like the late 60s when those three planets were last in alignment with each other. Uranus, the kind of the innovative, the liberating, Uranus is also associated with technology, the new, the exciting, the liberating, unexpected technological aspect of Uranus getting expanded by Jupiter, getting granted new heights, new growth, like we saw in July 20th, 1969, when there was the first lunar landing. There was a new level of technology, a new level, a new plane was reached, a new planet was reached. And of course, we have Pluto there propelling it, so it's even more inventive than it would be just with Uranus and Jupiter aligned just in themselves. With Pluto there, it's something that catalyzes the very kind of biological masses of humanity, like probably one of the most watched events on television, the lunar landing, everybody, butterflies in their stomach, everybody watching. So it's that sense of this collective inventive quality, and that will be with us for the next year. And along with that, we also have Jupiter giving an expansion to the plutonic kind of will to power, will to live, will to power, that can be very empowering. And if there's anybody who needs, if any of you listeners have something in your life which feels like it's old, it's outdated, it could be anything, it could be a sense of yourself, some aspect of yourself, you feel like you need to reach new heights, you need to turn over the mulch inside yourself and come up with some new growth and kind of compost those parts of yourself that are not serving you anymore. Now's the time. That's that big alignment, Pluto, Uranus, Jupiter, is the successful turnover into the new. The death and rebirth of Pluto is successful given Jupiter's kind of blessing of abundance. And particularly if you're born in the sun sign of Aries, if you're born in early to mid Aries, early the cardinal signs, early to mid Capricorn, Libra, or Cancer. That means that the alignment is right on top of your sun, a good time to turn over the identity, broaden, expand, become a fuller version of your potential, let go of anything that's not serving you anymore. But for anybody and everybody, it's going to land in your chart in some way, and you can always make use of that. You can always, whatever is probably meant to be let go of so that new growth can happen, will happen, but you can always accelerate that by acknowledging that and kind of setting the intention out there, acknowledging whatever you feel needs to be turned over, be mulch, where you need new growth. One thing to watch out for is that the will to power of Pluto, kind of the excitement of Uranus, releasing the will to power, the evolutionary drive of Pluto, when Jupiter gets in there, Jupiter is so expansive, sometimes it can over-elevate and kind of overblow that will to power. And if that will to power becomes associated with the ego, like, I'm so great, I am the force of change, I need to step out and change the world, and it's me, 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 then you can become quite overbearing. This can be a very overbearing transit. A great way to use this powerful energy that can be surging through us as individuals at the moment and also surging through the masses is to acknowledge that it's not your personal energy, but rather you are a vehicle for that evolutionary surge running through you. You are a vehicle for evolutionary change in the world. And that is our focus on Jupiter for the summer of 2013. So exciting. All of those things, all of those three podcasts, June, July, and August, can be thought of, returned to, reviewed for the entire year to come, because these three alignments will be with us for the next year, all the way through next May or so. So, very exciting year to come. Looking ahead, and once we're on the other side of it, looking back, it will be full of fireworks indeed. I hope you all have wonderful use of all the transits, and you, all your loved ones, and the world at large, make the most of it. All right, thanks for listening, y'all. If you have any questions, I can be reached at jamesmoran.co. That's my website. My email is james@jamesmoran.co. That's James Moran is MORAN .co.co. All right, everybody. Thank you so much.
And stay tuned. If you'd like to call in for a reading later in the show, you can do that at 646-716-5510, or you can Skype in from the show page. So if you'd like to do that, get in the queue now and enjoy my guest, H.R. Bremner, who is coming up next. Revolutionary guest today is H.R. Bremner, therapist, coach, certified sexological body worker, and licensed somatica practitioner. H.R. believes that our sexual creative energy is at the core of how we express ourselves every day. Using an integral therapeutic approach of compassion, sensitivity, empathy, and intuition, HR helps clients gently reconnect with their core desires in order to live a more empowered, passionate, free, and pleasure-filled life. As a therapist, sex educator, and community developer, he has expertise in sexual development and trauma. HR's focus is one of integral self-discovery through an exploration of the physical, mental, emotional, and social realm using psychology, social work, vision quests, retreats, ceremonies of various traditions, with a particular emphasis on Native American, and through the sexual and spiritual teachings from different traditions, especially the Julakwi Kwodushka teachings of the Sweet Medicine Sundance Path. So join the revolution in conversation around sex, intimacy, and relationships by helping me welcome this month's revolutionary guest, H.R. Bremner. So thank you, H.R., for joining us here on the show today. It's very kind of you to spend some time talking with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I think the first question that I'd like to ask you, just to familiarize you with the people listening, can you just give us a little bit of background in terms of the kind of work that you do and what brought you to this particular type of work and the focus that you've taken with
you? Yeah, I think a lot of why I focused on this was just exploring my own sexuality and wanting to come out, which I didn't do until I was 22. But even noticing in my relationship with my first boyfriend, but I was still trying to live in some sort of a, I guess, heteronormative, for lack of a better word, lifestyle. And I just wasn't fitting. And I didn't feel good and didn't feel quite right, but it took me 6 years to realize it. And part of what actually started to break things down for me was I did a master's in social work, and I did a lot of ceremony with some Aboriginal people back home near Toronto. And I started just to realize how I just wasn't in touch with myself. Like the whole unpacking my own cultural references in my master's in social work, and also being really privileged and honored and deeply immersed into another worldview, kind of started to shake everything up for me. I just started to see how important it was to be myself. And I think that really at the root of all of this, my desire for everyone is that they express themselves authentically. And what I've learned in different teachings over time is that the most powerful energy that we have in us is our sexual energy. And it's that sexual energy that's our creative energy. It's at the heart of everything. And it's not just physical sex. It's how we create in life. And that if we look at how we are sexually in our sexuality and we heal ourselves from shame and really allow ourselves to express ourselves fully, that we live much fuller, freer, happier lives. And we even give back to our society and our community in ways that we wouldn't have imagined. We feel more of a part of a community just because of that, because we're being more authentic in ourselves. And so in order to do this, I didn't know exactly where this was going to lead, but I knew that for me, there was a marriage between sexuality and spirituality. I was trying to figure it out when I was back home in Toronto. And then 5 years ago, the universe landed me here in San Francisco, and there were many things to learn from here. I was trying to do spiritual retreats for gay men. I was trying to do, you know, sexual exploration with people and getting them kind of out of their blocks and barriers around themselves and the shame that they have. And here in San Francisco, there was a guy who was doing retreats for gay men. These women that developed this great method called the Somatica Method that works with people around intimacy and relationship and what barriers that there are that are there for them in expressing themselves in those ways. And also another woman that I've been working with here who does energy work. I'm really looking at, you know, who are we? How do we express ourselves in relationship with people, not just sexually, but in general? What are the patterns that we constantly take on in our lives? Like, how do we live our life? Are we living hunkered down and waiting for life to happen? Are we out there so much that we forget ourselves? Are we really focused on what's right and what's wrong? So all of these things have really culminated together to teach me quite a bit about how people behave sexually, how people take their desires and kind of stuff them down, how long it can sometimes take, but actually how transformative and quickly sometimes things can happen from getting that desire from being buried down into actually coming to life within someone. And so it's the privilege really that I find of sitting with someone and being present with watching them get in touch with a part of them that they've forgotten about and letting that start to bubble up and then feeling the fire within them to actually live a life that's more passionate.
And a couple of the titles that you have in
yeah.
terms of the types of work that you do, I think are, one, probably not very familiar to people, and two, maybe very misperceived by people when they hear just the words that are used. And I'm referring to you're a certified sexological body worker. You're also a licensed somatica method practitioner. Could you explain what sexological body work is, what the somatica method is, and how you incorporate those into the work that you do?
Yeah, so the main modality that I use is somatica, and it's really creating a relationship laboratory, let's say. So if you are someone that's working with me, I would sit down with you and say, well, so what's happening in your relationships? Really focus first on what are you unhappy about? What do you want to change, perhaps? And then we create a relationship in the sessions that we work together, where just by getting close to you or by touching you in certain ways, and the reactions that you have and how you might close yourself down or open yourself up starts to really give us information about, well, what's happening? Why aren't you happy in your relationships? What are the patterns that might be unconscious that are kind of ruling how you interact with other people? And so the somatica method really works at getting underneath these patterns in relationship with someone. And so not like a traditional therapist that would sit there and be really objective and not really get too close and not share much of themselves. I actually, in the somatica method, will say, well, this is how this is impacting me. Because 9 times out of 10, if I'm being impacted like that, there's probably other people in their lives and the relationships that they're creating that are also impacted that way. So then how do we negotiate those boundaries in a way that we can be in intimate relationship with each other?
And somatica, just by the very nature of the word, is different than traditional therapy, because you're also not just sitting there with a notebook and pen.
Right.
Talking to the person, even if you're sharing with yourself, but it's very experiential and interactive.
Exactly.
But
yeah.
Physically interactive.
Yeah, and using things like breath work, using touch, exercises of proximity, you know, how close are we standing to each other, or how are we making eye contact, or, yeah, how am I reaching out to touch you, and what happens inside you, and really focus not only on just those physical movements, but also on, well, how are we impacted by our emotions and what are the feelings that come up inside us? And how do we get impacted by those? Maybe we stop breathing because we're feeling something inside, or maybe we start to tense up. And so really looking at what's happening in the body to really give us information. Really using the body as a tool. Like, it never lies. It always tells us what's going on.
And that may be why there's been such a, I don't want to say demonization of the body, but there's been a very negative kind of mindset built, and a lot of it is from religious things, etc., but there's been a very negative kind of thing built around the very nature of the physical body itself.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that I work with that just talking about genitalia makes them squeamish, right? Because somehow these are these dirty parts of ourselves, and, you know, in order to be satisfied sexually with a partner, or to even really be satisfied with yourself and your own pleasure, we have to have a relationship with these parts of us. We can't be divorced from our body. We're living in it.
And then can you explain a bit about what sexological body work is?
Yeah, so sexological body work is a bit different, where somatica is really about the relationship that comes up. Sexological body work is really focused on whomever I might be working with and their own physical experience of sex, their sexual energy. It's actually, some people call it somatic sex education. So what we're doing is actually working with people to learn about their bodies sexually. How do their bodies work? What are their parts like? And this actually comes back to being demonized for parts, is that people's genitalia, like there's a lot of women, because in our culture there tends to be this demonization, or, you know, saying that dirty, like those parts are dirty, like that kind of a thing. But there's a lot of women, like, they've never actually seen what their vulva actually looks like, or, you know, what the labia are like around the vagina. And being able to show them, you know, this is part of you. This is a part of you that you can love and work with. And so sexological body work really focuses on that part, where it's really like an education about how your parts work, what they feel like, how you can bring pleasure, and how you can move your erotic energy in a way that's empowering. So it moves through levels of shame around sex and sexuality. But it's really focused on the person that comes. And so a practitioner would be hands-on with that person, but there wouldn't be any two-way touch. Whereas in somatica, it's more about what's the relationship happening, and so there might be some touching of each other. It wouldn't necessarily be as genitally focused, though, as it is in sexological bodywork. So those are the two things that I work with people.
And you've used some terms, and I'm wondering if you can maybe just explain a bit of the the difference in definition between sex, intimacy, eroticism, sexuality, and then the idea of sexual energy. Because usually when people hear sex in any form, whether it's in the word sex, sexual, sexuality, sexual energy, the only thing they think it is about is it's going to be something that involves my genitals touching your genitals.
Yes, true. So eroticism, I'll start with that. I'd like to think of erotic energy, it's, again, harkening back to what I was talking about before, about that notion of our creative energy. And it's like, when that moves through us, when we get inspired by something, that, in a sense, is eros. We're getting inspired to create something. And so, physically, we're inspired to have sex to create, in a kind of heteronormative way, to create a new child. I think there's a bit of a myth around that. I don't think it's so biologically focused. I think biology hitches a ride on the energy. The energy wants to move. And then the biology says, hey, this is a good way for us to get procreation, and just kind of hitches a ride on it. But eroticism and erotic energy and what I will call sexual energy is all that. It's that notion of being creative. I'm going to create something.
And I think it's important for people not to get stuck on that idea of procreation, because certainly that's become a big sticking point with the whole gay marriage thing and this whole idea of the traditional marriage and what marriage is supposed to be about, whereas really the creation of a baby is a byproduct of the biological urge and the biological function. And it also, I think, has played into that, again, a kind of a demonization of pleasure for the self, that there is any pleasure to be had just through the process of sex.
Right.
Versus unless we're doing it with a goal. And I don't mean orgasm, although that's a whole other aspect stuck into as having that as the goal. You know, but if it's only about I have sex to procreate, and it's now become this thing of then if I'm doing it just because I enjoy it, there's something wrong with that, at least in some people's minds. You know, I think that what you said, I think it's important because creation isn't about having a baby. Creation is about using that energy to create anything.
Exactly.
You know, because the sexual energy actually is a very core energy in terms of magical work. You know, one of my favorite teachers, T. Thorne Coyle, you know, that's one of her five things, which is because there's will and love, but sex is one of those because sex goes to that core of ourselves, and it's where that spark of I want to do or create this in the world comes from. And if we're shut down or shut off from it in terms of expressing it with other people in relationship in some way, whatever that means, or even with ourselves if we're self-pleasuring, but if that is shut down, then we're actually very dramatically hindering our ability to go out and to create what we want in our lives and in the world. And I think that's why people who tend to be in positions of influence and power or great achievement or accomplishment tend to be either more sexual or tend to get caught up in these sexual scandals, because that energy is really stoked and flowing so strongly through them for what they've created in themselves and in their lives in terms of going after a CEO position, going after being a politician, going after being an Olympic athlete, whatever. And that's how I would want people to understand this energy, that that's what's flowing in you and you have the opportunity to tap into, and the work that you do is really helping them to tap into that to start creating themselves and the world and the life that they want, not just how do I have better sex to then have a baby.
Absolutely. And there's one of the teachers actually that I came here to work with, Michael Sigmund, he's the guy that does the Men's Inner Journey, And it's actually part of an organization that we're a nonprofit that we're really creating called the Gateway for Integrated Consciousness. And there's a book that he's writing right now, and it's really actually focused on exactly what you were just talking about how we look at sex and sexuality in our culture as at such a biological level that it leaves out so much experience in life, and it becomes very dual, like it becomes really male and female, and doesn't actually make room for something that's in between, which is what we as queer people embody in many ways, is that thing that's in between, that bridge. And so he's really been, he's pushing and writing with this book about saying that this third notion, which Harry Hay also talks about in some of his work, but that if we look at sex energetically, it makes much more sense, and queer people make much more sense. Like, there's a place for us, there's a reason why we're here. We're not, it's not just about procreation, it's about creating life in all its ways, which is exactly what you're saying. And so if we start to look at sex and sexuality and look at even each other and how we express ourselves energetically, then it's really just about sex and how we express is us coming together to celebrate life. It's this pleasure that we give each other, and we explode with the joy of just being with each other. And that's the reason for sex, rather than it being all about procreation.
That's why I've always wished we could drop the labels.
Yeah.
And instead of having heterosexual or homosexual or bisexual, that people, if we could just say, I'm sexual,
yeah,
then even though people associate the word with just the biological act, but if we just say that we're sexual, then it allows us to see that everyone is coming from that same core energy. And it's not about who it gets expressed towards. It's just, this is what's rising in me, and now this is how I want to express it. And I don't have to shut it down because it's not fitting into a proper label,
mm-hmm.
or it's going against something. And I think I would be curious what you've found are some of the biggest sources of things like shame or guilt or self-loathing or any of the things that people have really turned around on themselves and have created a very negative relationship with sex and intimacy and relationships.
Well, I will say that the notion of being wrong sexually, I think any form of sexual, say, denigration or any way where someone is made to feel like somehow sexually they're wrong are some of the most hard-hitting. I think if we look in the gay community, for example, one of the things that we really look at is if someone's sexuality is questioned, they feel like they don't fit. Like they feel like, I don't have a place here. And that suddenly becomes, well, I don't belong, and who I am is bad and wrong. And everything, that it's like the fire in their belly goes out. And there have been people that they get so focused then on trying to then perform out for everyone else and try to do the right thing and what should be done, and become really disconnected with that and get completely depressed because there's no juice behind it. They're just worried about everyone else. And when you get worried about everyone else, who ends up being happy? No one does, because you can't please other people. You can't please everyone. And if that's what your focus is on, trying to make sure that everyone else is happy with what you're doing, we're always going to be disappointed. We're always going to feel like we're not enough. And that's what I find something that comes up over and over again. A large percentage of the people that I work with, it keeps on coming down to that, just feeling like, well, I don't have a purpose here. I don't really know who I am. I don't really fit. And so that attack on someone's sexuality or how they express themselves, I think it's a really deep and hard-hitting one. And I think, you know, as far as cultures go and civilizations go, part of me wonders, like, did some of the leaders know that that was as powerful as it was? And is that why they started lesser rights for women, or, you know, banning people being gay or killing people who were gay in the past? Because that was a way to control the society that they were trying to have power over. Because, you know, you squash someone's sexual energy, you squash who they are somewhat, and so therefore they can't ever come into any sort of power within themselves. So they're easily controlled. even easily controlled with things like commercials that have, tell them what they should want and what they should buy.
Well, I was just going to say that because, you know, we always hear sex sells.
Yeah, exactly.
And sex is used to sell everything. It's amazing to me how they can take the most innocuous thing, like chewing gum, and use some sort of sexual or sexual overtone in a commercial to sell that. So why do you think that sex sells?
Well, I think it's partially what I just talked about. It's a sort of powerful creative energy. It kind of gets us going. It's our spark of life inside. But I also think that shame is a really powerful thing, too. And addictions are built on shame. If you don't have this voice inside you telling something's wrong, you're not going to get addicted to it. That's simply how it works. It's this notion that, oh, what I'm doing is wrong. I should be better. I'm doing it wrong. I should be better. And it builds up so much energy around a certain act that energy is constantly there. And so we're wanting to constantly follow that energy that's there to do that thing that's addictive. If it didn't have the energy there, if there wasn't that charge where that's bad or that's good, we would maybe do it every once in a while, but it wouldn't be this addictive pattern that gets built up. And so I think it's partially about shame. So in our culture, because there's so much shame around sex, and then we use sex to sell things, so people are like, oh, I want this, but oh, I shouldn't want this. And so then the energy gets built up there. This is actually something that I do with my clients. I show them that when you're with someone, just kind of going for it, just like jumping into them and wanting to be all close, the energy just kind of falls flat. There needs to be a little bit of seduction, a little bit of kind of give and take, push and pull, so that the energy starts to build up. So there's some excitement, like you don't know what's going to happen next. And when that energy starts to build up, then the experience becomes just so much more alive and so much full of more energy. So it's similar with this shame thing. Because there's more energy there, it doesn't matter what it is, life is going to follow the energy. And because shame builds up so much energy around something, that's where we keep on focusing on that thing. It becomes an addictive pattern. We're addicted to that shame. We're addicted to the feeling that we get from it.
And I think today people don't know how to throw one log on the fire at a time rather than get out the flamethrower.
Right.
But it really, I think, is fear, because now people are so afraid that if I don't do the flamethrower, it's going to go away.
Right, yes.
And then I'm going to be without.
Yeah.
And two, we've been so brainwashed by our society and our media that the only way to be happy in life is to be in relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And also, a lot of times, there's this implication that sex is what will make us happy or make everything better.
Mm.
And I think if people do the kind of work that you do with them, on the one hand, if they're reconnecting with their own internal fire, their own internal core of sexual energy, and it's coming from them, this is what all of the marketing people would be afraid of, because then they're not susceptible to the marketing, because you can't sell me something that's going to give me ecstasy, bliss, escape, etc., that I can't find within myself, so I don't keep needing something else and something more that they keep trying to sell me. So how would you recommend for people listening, for example,
mm-hmm.
what might be one way that they could start to assess themselves and say, am I disconnected from this? And what would be maybe a first step towards starting to reconnect with that within themselves rather than searching for it somewhere outside of them?
I think a really potent thing for people to do is to actually examine their masturbation practices. Do they self-pleasure? And when they do, are they really focused on a goal? Is it all about just getting off? Or do they enjoy it while they're doing it? I think part of how this whole consumer kind of mentality gets counteracted is it's that, like you were saying, that instant gratification thing, right? We're focused on the goal. We got to get it because then we'll be better. But you know, as many traditions teach us, it's not about the goal, it's about the journey. And so if we start to actually feel into the journey, be present with the journey, even in things like masturbation, or even like eating, make it that simple. If people are a little bit like, oh, I don't know if I can do that with my self-pleasuring or my masturbation, they could do it with eating. Taste your food. Take a moment. Take a breath. Take a bite. Taste it. Swallow it. Feel what it feels like. Take a take another breath. See if you want more. It's all about slowing down the process and seeing, well, what do I actually want at each interjection? Do I want another bite? Did that actually taste good? Do I want to eat more of this?
And not immediately assuming you can't, or you try it the first time and it won't, that it's too hard to do. So I'm thinking, for example, it's a very meditative technique actually that's also done, but I had a friend, for example, who had gastric bypass surgery. Mm-hmm. And so in the first few months, when she started eating more solid kind of foods again, it was a very kind of strict rule. She had to chew things at least 40 times before swallowing them, because as her stomach was repairing itself, it wasn't able to do the same kind of digestive process. So it had to be really macerated up. It had to be really chewed up enough to not cause discomfort. Mm-hmm. And trying that for the first few times was almost like torture, because it was like, I can't chew 40 times, you know? by 10 chews, they're ready to swallow, but that's kind of our habit. Mm-hmm. And also I think some of that, we're not trained to be able to slow down. But she also then experienced what you were just talking about, which is experiencing food very differently. Mm-hmm. And that suddenly there was more flavor, but also more subtle flavors to experience by spending time with it. It was a whole different experience of eating. And also, she didn't necessarily feel like she wanted to eat so much, versus she started to find that she was satisfied sooner or with less food, even though it might have taken longer to eat. But she didn't eat as much and still had a greater sense of satisfaction from what she did eat.
Yeah.
And I think that could easily translate over into sexual experience.
Absolutely.
You know, slowing down, spending time. I also had a conversation with someone recently. I said that it's possible to enjoy sex without having an orgasm. Mm-hmm. By orgasm, I was really referring to ejaculation. I mean, orgasm, I realize, has a much broader connotation to it, although I think a lot of people only think of orgasm as ejaculation, which is also a whole other conversation, because that seems to leave out females if you only think of orgasm as ejaculation. And I know there's female ejaculation, but people don't think of the physical, external, visible aspect of orgasm with women the way they do with men. Mm-hmm. You know, well, this person that I said that to was just flabbergasted and was like, oh no, that is just so not possible. If there's not an orgasm, then it wasn't a satisfying experience. And it's this getting caught up in, I have to achieve the goal.
Mm-hmm.
And if there isn't a visible indication that the goal has been achieved, then it's been a less than satisfying experience, and either I and or the other person or persons are not happy.
And I think it comes down again to what a number of spiritual traditions point to, that notion of the journey. And if we're not here to experience life, why are we here? Sure, we're here to make all these things and do that, but we're not here to do all this just for the sake of doing it. We're here to do it, to experience it. So if we slow down and actually let ourselves experience it, we'll be much more satisfied. There's a psychological model where one of the things that stops us from feeling like we've completed something is that we don't take time to integrate what we've done. And so then we keep on repeating it, or trying to repeat it. It's another thing that gets us wrapped in addiction, is because we don't think we've actually accomplished what it was we set out for, because we didn't take the time to celebrate or take the time to really integrate it into who we are. Just take those moments afterwards, like after an orgasm, just mm-hmm. lying there and enjoying it, rather than going, oh, better clean up, let's move yeah. on, right? Just lie there and enjoy it. Let yourself do that.
Well, I think that speaks to perhaps one of the things that you probably are working with people, but the way I tend to think about it is, first, I will say that I think it incorporates not having a separation or a difference between sexuality and spirituality. A lot of people think of those as very different. You know, our sexual, physical, carnal side versus, and it's usually in that term, versus our spiritual, sacred side. And, you know, it's much more important for people to understand that those two things are completely integrated, and there is really no separation between sex, sexuality, and spirit and the sacred.
Absolutely.
And part of the work I think you do and what you were just talking about is, how do you get people to work towards embodying their sexuality rather than it being almost something that is like a separate external experience for them, but is not then integrated and embodied.
Yeah, embodied and sacred.
And how would you go about recommending people start being able to recognize how they may not be doing that, and then something that they can do to start embodying their sexual experience and sexual self more?
In many ways, what I was saying earlier about masturbation, being able to slow that down, being able to feel it. How does it feel? Oftentimes what we do is we just go to fantasy. We're just in this fantasy world, and suddenly here we are having whatever orgasm we were putting as our goal. But what if we just stayed with the pleasure of feeling what was happening in our body when we touched ourselves? Staying with that. Or even looking at how are we having sex with other people? Are we just going there, we're actually thinking about someone else while we're fucking them, but we're not really present there with them in the experience? Sure, we're getting off and there's some pleasure in that, but we're not actually there in it. And so really evaluating, how are we interacting with other people? Are we just using them to masturbate, essentially? Or are we actually connecting with them and having a present experience with them? So those are some of the ways that we can evaluate it. Also, if the only way that... So I want to put a disclaimer here. I'm not saying porn is bad. If we're only masturbating to porn and that's the only thing that can get us off, sometimes that's an indication that we're actually not really feeling in our body what it's like to give ourselves pleasure. We're just there in someone else's experience, just getting ourselves off. Again, it's just getting to the goal. And so really looking at, how do we slow that down? How do we breathe into it? And there's actually a lot of breathwork techniques that can bring us close to orgasm just simply by breathing. They're really good exercises as well.
So how do you feel the internet, the easy access to porn, and things now with apps like Grindr and that kind of thing? And for people listening, apps like Grindr are simply apps that people can use on their smartphones. You can look and see who's close to you. It'll show you how close people are, and a lot of times they're used to find somebody close by so that you can then have a booty call. What kind of effect do you think the accessibility of all of that has had on people's view and relationship with sex and intimacy and relationship and relating to other people?
It's interesting. I think there's two sides to it. I think in some ways it's allowed people that were maybe a little more introverted to actually get out there and to actually be a little less inhibited on some levels. And I think on other levels, it has made things, it's made it like going to the corner store and getting some popcorn. And so when the notion of us, like I was saying, of us just needing to jerk off to get the goal, it's like, oh, well, I can go do that with someone else. And maybe it'll be a little bit more stimulating, but it's really, we're just living in a fantasy world rather than actually having a connection with someone. One of the things that I actually like on those is, rather than someone saying, oh, I'm just here checking things out, wanting to see who's around, talk to people, what people will say is, oh, I'm here checking things out, looking to see what's available.
And I find that being locked into that sense of what's my type has become more pronounced. Because people had to start describing it more, because everything, right, like on the internet and on these apps, you always have to create a profile, and a lot of times you don't have a lot of space. So you have to have this quick little description, and then you start thinking, what's the type that I'm looking for? Mm-hmm. So it becomes very narrow. It's kind of like Twitter, you know. It's like, in 140 characters or less, I have to tell you what turns me on, what I'm attracted to, and what you can't be. It becomes very limiting, but then we start living according to our profile description, and we start having a very limited experience, even out in the world, because we start, even if we're out in a public setting, we might be looking around, and if our eyes happen to fall on somebody, let's say that's Asian, we'll immediately keep our eyes moving because we've already determined our type is not Asian.
Right.
And so how would you recommend people start to kind of dissolve the very rigid boundaries and boxes that they have actually created for themselves and start opening themselves up to be more receptive to what experiences may come and may be there for them to have, rather than to be so actively looking for the kind of experience they think they need or are supposed to have.
Oh, that's a big one. I think this is probably one of the things that I work with most people on in a more general sense, just people getting out of their boxes. It's essentially what the work is about. In one of the traditions that I've practiced, we have these things called warrior task assignments. And what they would be is we would recognize whatever box we were in, and then we would create this task, this warrior task, that would then take us outside of our box. People might say, you know, edge stretching or out of your comfort zone, whatever.
So can you give an example of a box and then what a warrior task would be?
Yeah, sure.
To move
so
out of it?
Let's say, for example, like if we want to make it really sexual, well, let's just use the example about people being racist. Has whatever person that is putting, you know, not into Asians on there, have they actually sat down and talked to someone who's Asian? You know, what might they find if they actually sit down and get to know someone? So that would be the warrior task assignment. Find someone, talk to them. You know, see, although, you know, they might not want to talk to you. You know? But really, like, challenge yourself around these things. Like, recognizing what boxes we have put ourselves in, I think that's half the battle. We recognize the box, and then we can get ourselves out. But so many of us, we're so caught in the box, we don't even recognize that it's there. It can be a very liberating experience, and it can be very challenging for people as well.
And I think that's where one of the advantages of the internet versus the apps can actually come. Because when you engage, say, in online dating or like an online site to meet someone,
Yeah. Very
often, well, you really have more of a choice. I mean, you can do this in the apps, but usually people won't even bother to talk with you if you don't have a picture on your profile. But on the internet, it's much more common for people to have a lot of interaction through emails or through messaging through the site or something before ever actually even seeing the other person.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, that's become much less now, I think, because of the apps, because of things like Facebook and all that kind of stuff. But I think that would be one of the advantages of going through a more traditional online dating kind of approach, because you are going to get to know the person based on how they describe themselves, what they say they're interested in, and something about that is resonating for you or matching your interests.
Mm-hmm.
And you start talking with them and getting to know them as a person, and it may be that you now really like this person and can't wait to meet them. Then you meet them, and suddenly they don't meet the type that you physically, visually would normally think. And if you had seen a picture of them, you would have just passed right by them rather than taking the moment to get to know them. And so I think that that could actually be a very interesting tool to use for that task you were just talking about.
Yeah.
Because it takes away the visual and causes you. And if you want to do that with food in San Francisco, go to Opaque.
Oh, is that?
Which is a restaurant where you eat in complete darkness.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's a really, really interesting experience because it's a whole different way not only of interacting and experiencing your food, but also to interact with other people that you're with at dinner, because you aren't seeing their facial and visual and body cues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to listen differently, and you may make some assumptions based on what you're hearing, but it's a whole different way of having to interact and experience things. I think that's a perfect metaphor for like doing online dating but not doing the picture.
Mm-hmm.
So that you run less risk of maintaining your box rather than taking the risk of stepping outside of it because you don't know.
Absolutely.
But people don't like to take that risk.
It's true. People are uncomfortable with the unknown.
So I think there should be speed dating in total darkness.
There you go. I think that's a great thing. I think you should set that up.
That's what hopefully the work that you do helps people to start to move past not only their self-image and their own relationship with sex and sexuality and that kind of thing, but then to be able to translate that out and to start to see other people as another human that I want to connect with or interact with. And if it becomes physical, it's not just based around am I attracted to them on the visual, physical level, but it's because there's a whole other level of experience going on.
Yeah, this is actually one of the things, the retreats that I facilitate with Michael Sigmund, the Men's Inner Journey. It's a group of gay men, and we start out where people are, it's kind of in a very anonymous way, where people can't see each other, and they start sharing that way. And then there's various other levels of things that happen. I don't want to, you know, give too much away.
Is it like The Voice? Does each person come out and start talking about what they're like? And if somebody says, oh, I really relate to that, and they hit a button and their chair spins around.
It's not quite like that. But, but
for the next one, perhaps.
Yeah.
A little pop culture way of doing it.
But it's interesting, though, just to see, like, after 24 hours, the level of intimacy that shows up and how people really start to drop their masks and actually see each other as people rather than see each other as, you know, whatever box they fit into in the gayborhood. And I think that those labels, what you're saying there really, is that they just create either people fetishizing someone, like objectifying them, or rejecting them. But there's neither of those things do they actually connect with them.
Right. And that's what I think is much more prevalent now, is people are looking for and entering into, whether it's just to have sex or even entering into a relationship with, the type of person they've fetishized. That isn't enough to sustain a long-term relationship. But people only seem to go after that fetish that they have. So what's the difference between what you do and what someone who is called, say, well, a lot of times nowadays you'll hear sacred intimate.
Right.
It used to be sacred prostitute, but I think that has such a negative connotation that the terminology is now different, and sacred prostitute is much more referred to in terms of antiquity. You know, the sacred prostitutes in the temples and things like that, which of course is often said in a derogatory way, but it is not. Mm-hmm. But what's the difference between what you do and, say, a sacred intimate does?
Sacred intimate is usually focused more on the sexual relationship, and sacred intimates will frequently engage in penetrative sex with their opponents. Not always, though. What I do is more focused, it's like a layer removed from that, not removed, but a layer back or forward or somewhere different from that, where it's really looking at, well, what's the intimacy and connection that's created between us and what stands in the way from that always being there. I find that's really, it's in being able to free ourselves up and making those connections that we can then have sex in a way that's fulfilling. Although, you know, there is something also to be said for just getting off sometimes. But as far as, like, relationships and creating that kind of other thing go, it's really working that ability to communicate things about boundaries, to understand, you know, how we attach to people, and to be able to communicate our needs honestly. And I think actually that's another key thing, is that in our consumer society, where we're so focused on what we don't have and we better get it so that we can be a good person, that we forget what we actually really want. We get so focused out there. And so one of the things I keep on bringing people back to is, what's your desire? What is it that you want? What do you actually need here? Getting in touch with that and being able to communicate it honestly to someone without the fear that they're not going to get it or no one's going to be interested, but just being able to put it out there.
And I think that maybe, to me, speaks to the importance of the role that the sex worker plays in our culture. Mm-hmm. I know we often find that people in the sex work industry are, you know, either moralized against or seen as negative, or of course all of them came from the most horrific backgrounds and this is just a way of acting out all of their father issues or whatever. But I think that sex workers play a very important role.
Absolutely.
And I think that's one of the ways that they do it, because if someone is trying to find what it is that they really desire, I mean, you can find some of that perhaps through masturbation, but it also gives you a way to be with someone in a safe space. And, you know, I know people will argue about the whole payment thing, but I think that the payment thing is just an exchange for offering this space, this service, et cetera. You know, but it gives you that opportunity to explore what some of your desires may be. or gives you an opportunity to not put all of the weight on someone you're in a relationship with. If we talk about monogamy and how that's like the default way of thinking, what that really implies is I'm supposed to find someone who can be and provide everything to me all wrapped up in one person.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be that the person I'm with doesn't have any interest or doesn't find any pleasure in certain sexual things that I might like to do. And I think there's an importance with, say, a sex worker where somebody can go, of course, people have to make their own decisions about how this will work in their relationship. But, you know, if I want to be tied up and whipped, I know that's a very cliche example, but anyway, if I want to be tied up and whipped and my partner isn't into that, then perhaps going every once in a while to a sex worker who's going to be able to provide that for me takes the burden off of my partner and says I don't build up resentment towards that person. My partner doesn't feel like there's some sort of pressure to do something that they don't want to do or feel comfortable doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have to threaten the relationship. Which then, if you broaden that out, is encouraging people to determine what the way of defining relationship for them and what works for them is more important than what they've been told it's supposed to look like.
Absolutely.
So if it's with one person, fine. If you're in relationship with multiple people, polyamory, but if that is what will work for someone, allow yourself the freedom to explore that and to say this is what is right for me, rather than what you keep referring to is defaulting back into the heteronormative model that we're kind of embedded with from birth, because that's more what we get from the overculture.
Mm-hmm.
Find that and allow that, and don't worry about what somebody else has to say about it, because they're not the one that's in that relationship.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, we have to be empowered in our own relationships.
So what would be one step that you would leave listeners with to say, here's what you can start doing today to empower yourself to come back to a more embodied and connected point within yourself, to your sexual energy, your sexual core?
I guess I would say slow down and take a breath. Feel into, are you happy in certain situations? Where are you happy and where are you not? And find out what's keeping you from being happy. And just to add some juice to that, really explore with your self-pleasuring. Find ways that you can give yourself pleasure that you may have been a little shy to do in the past. See if you can get outside the box and how you make yourself feel good.
And I think if somebody finds that they're having, if they're struggling to identify that in themselves or struggling to know some ways to start doing that for themselves, don't be shy, don't be embarrassed, don't
right.
be afraid to seek out someone like you who does that kind of work, because you and the people that do your kind of work are there to offer a space where it's okay to do that rather than to embarrass you
yes.
or to judge you or to try to get you to conform to what the overculture says is the norm, because there really isn't a norm.
Right, exactly.
And if people did want to reach out to you, could you just let us know the best way for people to do that?
Sure. Email or phone. So my phone number is 415, the area code, 577-6687. And my email is hr.everhart@gmail.com.
So to end each conversation with my guests,
mm-hmm.
I do two things. One, I have a question I will ask you that my previous guest posed, not knowing who my next guest would be, but simply put this forth as their question.
Mm-hmm.
And then I will ask you to pose a question for my next guest that will be on the next show. And the question that comes from my previous guest, who is Joseph Ernest Martin, and he's a psychic and a tarot reader, but also very heavily involved in the world of UFOs and conspiracy theories and extraterrestrials and stuff. So his question was, when have you been the most satisfied in your life?
I have to say, there's been many times, but right now, it's like I'm really learning how to just take in what is around me. I don't have to like everything. It's almost like just being able to feel the fact that life is moving is enough. Even if it's sad sometimes, it's still life. And that, the power of that, how powerful that is for me. And so right now I'm just newly in a few months into a relationship and really feeling the notion that I'm enough. And that whoever this person is, like they're never going to be that perfect thing that I'm looking for out there. But there's always some beautiful thing that's opening up that I can learn. And sometimes it's hard, and sometimes it's joyful. And just knowing that I'm enough and that I can learn in every moment has really made life really satisfying for me lately.
And I would encourage everyone listening, ask yourself that question as well. When have you been the most satisfied in your life? And if you can't say right now, ask yourself what was happening and why you were so satisfied at another time, and how you can perhaps come back to that place at this point in your life. And then what question would you like to pose to the next guest?
My question is going to be, what is it that you do that gives you the most pleasure?
And if any of our listeners want to share their response to that question, feel free at facebook.com/revolutionwithhyc. We're happy to hear your input and what it is that you might say to that question. Well, thank you very much, HR, for being willing to be here today.
Thank you, HyC. It's been a pleasure.
And hopefully everyone listening has learned a little something, perhaps been challenged to evaluate something within themselves from some of the things that you've said and put forth. And I would encourage people, especially if you're in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, and feel like you want to do some work around these areas, to get in touch with HR. And again, you can do that at his phone number, which is 415-577-6687, or at his email address, which is hr.everhart@gmail.com. So thank you very much, HR, and stay tuned. If you'd like to call in for a reading during the show, we'll be doing that a little later. You can call 646-716-5510, or you can Skype in from the show page. And coming up, we're going to have our Living Well segment. But if you want to get in the queue for a reading, I would encourage you to do that now, because there's often many people waiting. So we will be right back.
Once again, I'd like to just say thank you to H.R. Bremner for having joined us today, and I hope everybody listening enjoyed what he had to say and maybe was a little bit challenged by some of the things and are willing to explore some of the things he mentioned, some of the things he suggested, which might even mean exploring yourself. And if you can do that with yourself, or if you can do that with somebody else, I wanted to offer for this magical moment a couple of little suggestions for some aphrodisiac blends that you could make up very easily for yourself. I will base them on essential oils. One thing I will tell you is, if you listen to the different ingredients that are in these, then you can use one or any of them. They all have an energetic and even a physiological property to them that stimulate desire, passion, sexuality, etc. So even if you don't have all of these to put together, using one or a couple of them also, you can do that. And the blends I'm going to give you are essential oil blends, but you could also use the herbs, the dried herbs for them. So you could make a tea. You could use these things to cook with. So any way that you could find or use those ingredients, they're in any form, they're going to have this kind of energetic quality to them. So you could make a nice little meal with some of these ingredients and do that for someone else. And even without them realizing, you'll be stimulating their interest, let us say, for what comes with or after dessert. And to make these, you could just literally blend the oils together, and then you can put a little bit of the oil, and these would be done in a carrier oil. Carrier oils are things like jojoba, almond oil, sunflower oil, fractionated coconut oil. Those are just things to put the drops of essential oil in, and that allows you to put it on your skin and not really risk sensitivity from the straight essential oils that some people can have. So you can make a blend like that in a carrier oil and then use it on your skin as a moisturizer, or, you know, put a little on when you're going to go meet someone special, or if you're just going out to want to meet someone for the night, this will help to attract them. You can also make a spray using the essential oils, and that's very easy to do if you just get a bottle, say like a little 4-ounce bottle with a spray top, like the atomizer kind of spray top. I don't know how to describe it. I would think it's the kind of top. And you just fill the bottle mostly with water. Make sure you leave a little bit of room, because when you put the essential oils in, they're also going to cause the liquid to rise. So you don't want to fill all the way to the top with water. So fill mostly with water, a teaspoon of vodka. The vodka is just a way of keeping the oil and water mixed, as well as helping to preserve the oil better. It can be a cheap vodka, that's fine. You don't have to have the expensive stuff. Save that for when you have the person over and want to give them a little pre-dinner cocktail. And so you put the water, teaspoon of vodka, and then the drops of essential oil in, shake that up, spray, you're ready to go. You can spray that on yourself. You can spray it in the room so that you can get that energy out into the space and into the room. You could spray a letter you're sending to someone. You could spray the pillow. You could spray inside the car when you're going to go pick them up. So there's, you know, a variety of ways that you could use these. So again, the easiest ways to do it, a carrier oil such as jojoba, sunflower oil, almond oil, fractionated coconut oil, take a bottle of that and add the essential oils to it, or make a spray by filling a bottle mostly with water, teaspoon of vodka, and then the drops of essential oil. Those are two of the easiest ways, or if you get them in other forms than essential oils, teas, adding them to foods, etc. So here's a couple of recipes that you can use. The first one, this is probably the simplest one because it's only 3 essential oils, and this is a very, very easy one to do. You would do 10 drops of wild orange essential oil, 4 drops of lavender oil, and 2 drops of ylang ylang. Ylang ylang is Y-L-A-N-G, and then again Y-L-A-N-G. Now, these are suggested amounts of the drops. You can adjust those according to your preference, mainly based on smell. If you find that one scent is a little overpowering to the other scents, add a couple of drops of the other ones. Sometimes if I'm experimenting with blends, I will start with a base, like 5 drops of each oil, see how that smells. If something is a little strong, I might add a couple of drops of the other ones and then find what that blend is. And then make sure you record that so that you can make it again very easily. So once you find the right proportion of drops, you know, you can always go back to having recorded it and then easily make a new batch whenever you need it. So again, that was the suggested combination here. Was 10 drops of wild orange essential oil, 4 drops of lavender, 2 drops of ylang ylang. Now, here's a couple of recipes, one specifically for women to use, one specifically for men to use. They have some similar ingredients, but there's a couple that are switched. So for a woman, and this is kind of based on the fact that there are energy aspects to certain oils that are more feminine. They tap into that feminine aspect or energy or quality of the person. So for a female, this would be a recommended blend. 4 drops of jasmine oil, 3 drops of sandalwood, 2 drops of patchouli, 4 drops of ylang ylang, 3 drops of rose, and 3 drops of vanilla absolute. Now, vanilla absolute technically is not an essential oil because you can't really get an essential oil from vanilla. It's mixed with a little bit of alcohol, but find something called vanilla absolute, and usually you can find it with anybody that sells pure essential oils. You don't want to use vanilla extract necessarily. Or if you're putting this into a carrier oil or even into a spray, but especially into a carrier oil, you can just take a vanilla bean and open it up and then just drop the vanilla bean into the bottle of oil and just leave it in there, and then that'll mix and get infused into the oil along with the other essential oils. So again, that was for a woman, and I'll just repeat that very quickly. 4 drops jasmine, 3 drops sandalwood, 2 drops patchouli, 4 drops ylang ylang, 3 drops rose, and 3 drops of vanilla absolute. Now, if you'd like to make a blend for a man, or if you are a man, again, just because energetically some of these tap into and connect a little more directly with that masculine aspect, here would be a blend for that. 4 drops of Atlas cedarwood, 4 drops of sandalwood, 2 drops of patchouli, 3 drops of peppermint, 4 drops of lavender, 3 drops of ginger. So again, combine those either in a carrier oil or you can make a spray using those as well. And then the last one I'll give you is something that is really good at it has a fiery or a heating aspect, so it really can stimulate the flames of passion, romance, desire, and sex. So this isn't about trying to attract somebody or trying to get them to fall in love with you per se, as it is to really want to heat things up between the two of you. So that particular blend is 3 to 4 drops of cinnamon, 1 drop of clove, 2 drops of peppermint, 1 drop of ginger, 1 drop of jasmine. You could also use rose instead of jasmine, depending on which scent you prefer. And 3 to 4 drops of vanilla absolute. The one thing I would say, be really careful here. Cinnamon oil can be very burning on the skin, so you really want to make sure you have enough carrier oil. I mean, if you're using like a 4 or 5 ounce bottle of carrier oil with this amount of essential oil drops, like 3 to 4 drops of cinnamon, you're going to be perfectly fine. But just be really careful with cinnamon oil because it can be very burning to the skin when put on there directly. But that's a great blend. You can make a massage oil from that, you know, but that's a great blend to really stoke that fire. So hopefully you might go get a couple of essential oils, make up a blend here, make up your own blend. Those are certainly all of those oils that are mentioned are really good for helping to stimulate those kind of things. They have a very aphrodisiac quality. If you do that and you would like to talk about what you made or the results you saw from it, we'd be more than happy to hear about that. You can just go to the Facebook page, facebook.com/revolutionwithhighc, and share your recipe, share your experience with that. And I will just remind you that these shows are always archived. So if you didn't catch all of those ingredients, you can always listen back to the show either here on Blog Talk Radio. It'll always be here on the show page to listen to or download, or you can find it on iTunes Just do a search for Firefly Willows Live or for Revolution with High C, and it'll come right up, and you can download the podcast or listen to it there as well if you need to. So stay tuned. Coming up next is our Living Well segment, and then right after that, we will have our phone lines open so that you can get a reading here on the air during the show.
I am Linda Wiley, and this is Living Well with Linda. Your monthly guide to the well-being of your body, mind, and spirit. It's about an alternative approach to life, healing, and living well in our changing world. Let food be thy medicine, and medicine be thy food. A return to this understanding of the truth of food and the value of food within our lives. Our body is a machine for living. It is organized for that. It is its nature. Let life go on in it, unhindered, and let it defend itself. It will do more than if you paralyze it by encumbering it with remedies. Leo Tolstoy, War and Peace. To realize our connection with all of life and the plant and animal kingdom and how we support and help each other in our process. I am Linda Wiley, and this is Living Well with Linda. As I think of this month, what comes to mind is the approaching end of summer. And at the same time, it is the height of summer in many ways. I always look forward to August because for me it is the apex of summer and fun and enjoying. It is usually the hottest month, though September can be very warm as well, depending on where you live. It's when I love summer best. The hot, dry days and gentle breezes fill me with a sense of deep peace and utter joy. It's a sensuous time of year as well, for the weather is comfortable on the skin. The hot days make for the warm, lingering nights, and it feels like summer vacation, river going, drifting on the shore in mind and spirit, freedom. Tan on the bod feels so good. Barbecue dinners on the deck with a few drinks, the setting sun, good friends, good conversation, laughter, freedom. Deep enjoyment. Bliss. It's the way life was meant to be lived. Fresh fruit from the garden to top it off. It's a time to savor and enjoy as we take respite from the sun or be in the sun at the river or on an island, in the park, on a walk. It's time to gather the forces of summer in our arms and dance with it. Get dressed up in that summer dress. Let the warmth of the sun warm the heart and soul. For surely winter is coming, and that warmth will serve us well. But for now, remember the simple enjoyment and fun of your childhood. Playing in the summer sun, carefree as the birds in the blue, cloudless sky. The courts held, the plays performed, the fantasies lived, mom calling for dinner. Summer in August is a time to relax, to relish the pure joy of being alive right now. Nothing revives and cools and soothes more than a trip out in nature. A weekend to the beach or a mountain lake, or a simple drive in the beauty of your area will do wonders for the stresses and strains of life. Cools one off. Dip your feet in the river and let it carry your fears and worries out to sea. Make a plan to have a summer dinner party, complete with dancing. Let the spirit fly in the fullness of the summertime as the cares of the world melt from within and the dream of life continues. I feel that enjoying ourselves and having a good time is not only the truth of life and health of life, but a way to break the spells of the program. For community is the truth of life and will be how life can recreate itself and regenerate itself. Meanwhile, we are having a dinner party out on the deck. Candles are lit, people are coming, music is happening, lights are soft. It's sunset and the dancing has begun. But before this, there was a dinner. So here's our summer dinner menu. We have stuffed squash blossoms with a tarragon or pesto or both, roasted garlic and red peppers, olives, bread, crackers, and cheeses. Those are the appetizers. And then dinner is marinated grilled chicken thighs with avocado pineapple salsa, stuffed baked garden potatoes, massaged greens, marinated grilled summer squash, yellow romano beans, red bell peppers, and cherry tomatoes. Dessert is white peaches, strawberries, raspberries, and blueberries, all fresh from the garden, coconut bliss ice cream, raw chocolate sauce, and raw cookies. Bon appetit. So here's some tips for our summertime in August. Let yourself enjoy it all. Feel the peace and upliftment of summer, the coming into fullness, the bursting forth, the giving of love, the trusting of life, the carefree wonderment. It's important to remember this for our health and well-being. Savor is a wonderful word. Dictionary says, to enjoy it, life, food, drink, whatever it is, to enjoy it completely, to enjoy it completely. That says it all. To enjoy it completely, fully, satisfied, fulfilled, happy. Be present, be here now, feel it, let go, dive deep, peace. Drink lots of water, sleep with the windows open without fans or air conditioners if possible. It keeps us more in touch with the truth of the season in our area. This promotes health as well. Soak up that sun, collecting as much vitamin D as you can. Use wisdom when being in the sun. Sun is just such an important part of health. Walk barefoot on the grasses and gaze at the setting sun and rising sun for a few moments, letting the light enter into your eyes and fill up your body. Use caution, just a few seconds when the sun is very low on the horizon. Just go and let yourself have fun. Read a novel, some light reading that you can escape into as you swing in the hammock, or the book on your favorite subject that you've been wanting to explore. Don't worry, the time of inner looking is coming. But for now, it's lighthearted playfulness as the magic that is summer displays itself. And we imbibe, and we imbibe, and we imbibe. There's a lovely video that you might like to enjoy. It's called The Dream of Life by Arthur and Fiona Christian. So The Dream of Life is an alternative looking at life. It's about community and includes permaculture, and it's a lovely looking at how life could be. And then on YouTube, there's a Melissa Etheridge tune called Gently Re-Row with Lyrics. It's a lovely tune as well. So for now, enjoy this often romantic, dreamy summer vacation feeling time of year with friends and family. Grow and share food, create community, promote thrivability, share life. It matters. Share life. It matters. And remember, it's only a dream. It's only a dream. It's only a dream. Thank you for joining me today for this segment of Living Well with Linda. I'm Linda Wiley. If you would like to chat further with questions, comments, or consultations, please contact me at linda@prestia.com. Thank you and blessings to all. Blessings to all. Have a great rest of the day.
And stay tuned, because coming up in just a minute, we will be having our call-in segment where you can receive a reading live on the air. If you would like to get in the queue for a reading, just call 646-716-5510, or you can Skype in from the show page. So we'll be back in just a minute to start taking your calls and hear what questions and guidance the Tarot has to offer. Stay tuned.
A personal tarot reading can offer you insight, information, enlightenment, and empowerment along your life's path. Hi C is a professional tarot conversationalist and ritualist with over 10 years' experience. He's available for readings in a variety of formats, including parties and events. To schedule your personal tarot reading, contact Hi C at tarotbyhic.net or email him at hic@fireflywillows.com.
And we are back and ready to take your calls. Operators are standing by. Well, I will admit this operator is sitting by, but there you are. We're still here for you. So I think we'll go ahead and go to our first caller who's waiting on the line and has been very patiently waiting. And this is someone calling from area code 720. Are you there, caller?
I am.
Well, welcome to the show. Can I? Can I ask your name and where you're calling from?
Yeah, my name is Sven. I'm calling from sunny, beautiful Denver, Colorado.
Well, one doesn't often think sunny with Denver. Well, thanks for calling in. And what is it that you'd like for us to look at for you today?
This has been an exceptionally great year for me, and I want to know basically if my good fortune and positivity will last, specifically maybe in the area of love.
Okay. Is there a particular relationship, or are you just wondering about your love life in general coming in the future?
Yeah, I am currently seeing somebody, but things have gotten a little rocky, confusing lately. So, yeah, I guess I would like to focus on that.
Well, we will look at that, and then there may be cause to look at other areas of your love life.
Sure.
So I wouldn't necessarily give up on the relationship just yet. The card that came up for you is the Moon card, and that is a card that often indicates things like mystery, the hidden, the unknown. So it shows us that you may be kind of are unsure, unclear, that it's a bit of a mystery as to where are things, how do things stand, what's going on. This can also be a card of deeper emotional things that are getting stirred up or brought to the surface. So you might want to take some time to sit with yourself and see what is it that is coming up for you in response to how the relationship is going, something the person did, things that have been said, because it seems as if it's connected to, think of the Moon like past lives. And whether we think in terms of reincarnation, past lives, or just the idea of, you know, if I'm 30, when I was 20, that was three lifetimes ago. Think in terms of the past, because there's probably something about this person, the situation, or something that is happening that is triggering something from the past and creating doubt, creating upset, creating concern that may or may not be warranted, because it may just be a reaction to the past rather than something that is really about the present. And, you know, the card that came up for the other person is the One of Water or the Ace of Cups. And that can actually be a card that represents, sometimes it's like new love, new relationship. This may show somebody who is either developing new feelings or is starting to experience a different or a new level of feeling towards you, towards this relationship. So it's actually a very nice kind of card to see on their part. It also shows a very much of an openness. Like here in the deck I'm using, it's called Open Channel. So it shows that right now that person is in a very open and receptive mode. So if you are willing to engage in the kind of conversations and bring some of the things up that need to be, then this person is in a very receptive mode to listen to that, hear that, engage in that conversation right now. I will say with One of Water, Ace of Cups, sometimes that can be kind of an overwhelming sense. It's like water overflowing the cup. So there can be a sense of experiencing so much emotion or too much emotion all at once that we don't know what to do with it. And so we tend to kind of pull back from it. Like Ace of Cups can be a very intuitive or psychic card, and this is where somebody suddenly their intuition is, or their psychic abilities are suddenly waking up, and they're getting all sorts of psychic messages, and it's so overwhelming that they either get afraid of it or they don't know what to do with it, and so they suddenly try to shut it down or back away from it. But it's really more about needing to learn how to understand it and work with it rather than to shut it down. So this person may be experiencing that sense of overwhelmingness and not know what to do with what they're feeling. And that's why that need to engage in conversation gently is very important right now, because it will help to, and this can be, depending on how long you've been in a relationship, whether it's going to couples counseling, going to a workshop, or just doing something that is about engaging the process to be able to speak and to be heard by the other. I mean, if you were listening to the interview that we just had, it's that idea of really being present with the person, creating a space where they can feel that they can both speak, be heard, and also listen to what you have to say in a way that is non-judgmental, that is open and allows for whatever to be said or needs to be expressed to be expressed. And sometimes that means we don't even have to react or respond to it. But that will help to, it's kind of like we're going to be the paper towels to help mop up some of the excess emotion that's overflowing the rim of the cup. And we just want to help to kind of clean that up rather than trying to tell them what to do or suddenly grabbing the cup and dumping the water out. It's just let's slow this down to a little bit more of a trickle so that it doesn't become overwhelming and we're not creating more of the overflowing process. And certainly the relationship card that came up, the reversed Three of Fire, says keep this close to home. You know, Three of Fire is a card of expansion, and reversing it is cautioning us against trying to expand too quickly or to go outside of the bounds of where we're at too soon. And instead we need, it's kind of like saying take care of what's in your own backyard before worrying about taking care of everybody else in the world. So keep this very kind of localized, like in the conversations, keep it very simple and keep it very focused and limited, maybe to just one thing at a time in the conversation, rather than trying to talk about every issue and resolve every conflict in one conversation so that we can move forward. That's what will feel overwhelming. But if we can break it down into that trickle and just say, you know, let's just have a conversation about this one thing, and then we'll enjoy ourselves, or we'll not worry about anything else, we'll just have that one thing, that may be helpful in this situation. So there certainly, you know, isn't a reason to give up on the situation, but I think that either something has been done or something has happened to cause it to feel like, you know, the water's on too high and it's filling up and overflowing the edges before I'm able to contain it and deal with it. And we need to slow that flow down so that we can kind of step back, relax and ease back into it, and then take it at a little bit more of a trickle kind of pace.
Wow, that is dead on what has been going on. She is in a place where she is feeling responsible for many people's emotions and feelings, including mine, and the representation of water overflowing a cup is very appropriate. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Sure. Well, thank you for calling in.
Well, thank you.
Hopefully that helped
a
little bit.
It has. I mean, you have no idea how accurate that was to what is going on. And it is kind of comforting to know that we may still have a shot at this if I pull back a little bit, keep it in perspective. I'm a fairly passionate man, and it is difficult for me to do that, but I will try.
All right. Well, I wish you luck with that, and feel free to call in the future and let us know how it turns out.
I will. Thank you very much, I see.
All right. Enjoy the day.
Thank you, you too.
And that'll conclude our show for the day. So thank you very much for listening. Hopefully you enjoyed that, got some helpful little tips. And remember that you can always find the show in the archives if you need to revisit the conversation or the recipes for the oil aphrodisiac blends. So thank you for listening, and I encourage you to listen on Tuesday to the Amethyst Oracle, which I co-host with my co-host on there, Charlie Harrington, and we'll be hearing about divination and oracles in ancient Egypt with author Richard Reedy.
Thank you for joining us. This program was brought to you by Firefly Willows LIVE. We hope you enjoyed the show. This is Deb Caracella. Please join us next time on Firefly Willows LIVE for Amethyst Oracle, Divination with a Queer Twist, with Heisey Ludmers and Charlie Harrington, Tuesday evening at 8 p.m.